now in Gainesville, which is in central northern Florida, I guess, to describe it. About 90,000 people, university town, I think, between to say. Are you going to introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name is James Schmidt. I'm the coordinator, one of the two co-coordinators here at the Civic Media Center, which is our local info shop and community organizing space.
And tell me a bit about Gainesville itself.
Oh, let's see. Gainesville, like you said, is about 90,000, roughly, total population, and of those, upwards of 50,000 are college students, the majority of whom are at the University of Florida, and the others attend a pretty sizable community college that we have here called Santa Fe Community College. So it's a really strong youth culture kind of town, a typical college town in North America, or especially in the United States, I should say. There's kind of a college town culture that has a similar manifestation all around the country in kind of small and medium-sized college communities like, for example, Missoula, Montana, Boulder, Colorado, Gainesville, Eugene, Oregon. I think Arcata, California, if I'm remembering correctly, has a college there.
So in terms of issues for people living in the town, what would you see as the major sort of issues people are facing?
Poverty is one of them. It's a low-wage, low-rent kind of town because of the university. And I think, you know, I was kind of mentioning the common culture that you can find in a lot of university and college towns. Perhaps Gainesville is a little more of a low-income kind of town because it's, you know, we're in the Deep South. It's an anti-union, so-called right-to-work state here in Florida. So there aren't strong unions. There are some unions. The strongest unions in town are on the campus, actually. The faculty and graduate student unions are relatively powerful, especially the graduate assistants union is a pretty fierce fighting union that's won some really solid gains for those folks over the last 5 or 10 years. But most of the workforce is not organized in any way, shape, or form, and the majority of folks in town work in the service industry one way or another, especially food service is huge here, retail, you know, and things like that. So it's a minimum wage kind of town. And if you look at the numbers on paper, you know, I've seen some numbers that were generated by a living wage campaign that folks put together a couple years ago. Just on paper, it doesn't add up. You know, the cost of living for a family on even two minimum wage salaries, the cost of living is higher than what they're making. So, you know, folks are really, really hurting, scraping by, and especially with even like the slightest economic downturn like we're seeing right now. You know, we are in a recession. The far right doesn't want to, you know, in the capitalist class doesn't want to admit it, but that's what's going on. And I'm seeing, you know, gas shortages and other kind of really obvious examples of how that's working. So, but other issues that folks face around here, there's a fairly strong environmental movement, and there have been some, relatively speaking, for Florida, some pretty decent gains in terms of conservation and trying to move the general culture on the university campus and in the city towards a more green and ecologically sustainable perspective. But of course, you know, these are just like liberal reforms, so there's a long way to go on that. And Florida is under incredible pressure as far as development goes. You know, there's just an insane number of people that are moving to the state every year. You know, I can't quote numbers at you, but anywhere that you hear statistics, it's just unbelievable the pace of development. It's slowed down a lot, you know, with this recession that supposedly is based on the housing bubble bursting, and you can really see that around here. You know, it's not so much that we're having a massive wave of foreclosures like some of the urban zones are, but house building has slowed down, you know, and the only like construction that's still going is related to the university in general. You know, a new hospital going up that's connected to the university, a new hotel going up that's connected to the university, but even some major redevelopment projects that the city backed and handed a bunch of tax breaks and cash incentives to the capitalists involved have been put on hold indefinitely. So there's like a whole city block worth of buildings that were knocked down right at the major corner of University Avenue and 13th Street here in town, which is right across the street from the University of Florida, and this gigantic, you know, fancy sort of, you know, upper middle class condos and shops below kind of thing was supposed to be under construction starting, you know, several months ago, and it's on hold indefinitely. So there's evidence of, you know, economic troubles that you can kind of see and point to. And then at the state level, we're sitting in this part of north central Florida on top of the Floridan Aquifer and other, you know, underground water sources that bubble up into a number of springs around here. It's a beautiful region, ecologically speaking and geologically speaking. There's just these lovely springs all around the area, and people enjoy recreation in them, and provides a, you know, good source of quality water for the area. But south of us in central and south Florida, there are severe water shortages. We've had waves of drought over the last 5 or 10 years, and we're basically in the midst of a low-intensity water war, politically speaking, where south and central Florida want the water that north Florida has, and they're, you know, playing all sorts of political games and monkey business at the state level and through the regional water management districts to try to grab our water, you know, and it's going to become a really ugly issue, I think, within the next 10 years or so. So, yeah, those are some of the big issues.
Okay, and we're sitting in the Civic Media Center, which I think has been here for 15 years, you were saying. It's a big space, certainly by Irish standards, which is extremely jealous of the size of this space. That's here. Do you want to tell us a bit about us?
Yeah. This is our local information insurgency, as I like to call it. We have managed to build and maintain the Civic Media Center over the last 15 years, starting in 1993 with an organization, a little group of folks called the GAP Group, the Gainesville Alternative Press Group, and they were meeting in the back of a local bookstore, and they had a little tiny display, you know, promoting alternative media, and the folks in the GAP Group were all basically the editors of local left and alternative papers and magazines of different sorts, and they decided that what they wanted to do was to have a real space, a space that was all their own, to promote alternative media and get, you know, access at the community level to information that was just being either left out of or incompletely covered in the mainstream corporate media. And they were alarmed by the mega trend of media consolidation, you know, in the 80s that just picked up and, you know, went astronomical in the 90s, to the point where, you know, you had like dozens of entities that owned and controlled the majority of the media, and then it was down to 9, and then a couple years later it was down to 6, and now I think it's like 4 or 5 maybe. So they you know, decided that they were going to try to fundraise and organize and figure out how to open a space, and they were inspired by the example of the Alternative Reading Room in Asheville, North Carolina, which was I believe, and I could be wrong about this, but I believe it was a non-lending library of the alternative media, so you could use the publications and the books that they had in-house just on the premises, but you couldn't check things out. And they wanted to take that a step further and have a library that was a lending library and make the material available to go out into the community. And it just happened that Noam Chomsky had been scheduled to speak on the University of Florida campus during the Gulf War. A local peace group had signed him up to come down and talk. And, of course, the Gulf War didn't last very long, the original Gulf War. But Chomsky's schedule being, you know, set 2 years ahead, he was still on the docket to come talk at the university. So they took advantage of that. They invited him to come and participate in opening the Civic Media Center in October of 1993, and then he spoke later that night at the University of Florida campus, and that was how I got involved. I was in the crowd to hear Chomsky speak, and the Civic Media Center, you know, they gave a little talk about the project and then passed a sign-up sheet through the crowd, and a bunch of us signed up to volunteer. A pretty ingenious aspect of the Civic Media Center that has allowed us to survive and grow was a membership program. So in order to be able to check materials out from the collection, you gave a voluntary donation of $10 to $20 on a sliding scale, smaller for folks who plead low income, you know, and that's an annual renewable membership. And that allows us to have this funding base, you know, that's in the community and makes us directly responsive to the community, you know. And so that, I think, was a really smart move. I think if we had tried to be a radical bookstore, you know, or get by selling alternative papers, we would have closed the doors in a year. But because we had that way of getting people more directly involved, you know, we've managed to grow pretty well and survive despite some ups and downs.
You're also involved in the local IWW. Mm-hmm. Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, Industrial Workers of the World got started in Gainesville. We formed a general membership branch back in 98, and that initial incarnation lasted until about 99, 2000, and then a lot of the folks that were more active had moved on at that point, sort of the eternal problem of a college town, you know. A lot of the folks were students or younger people who moved on for one reason or another. So then we revived the GMB in 2004, and it's been going ever since. Like a lot of IWW groups, especially in smaller towns, it's a relatively small group of folks, you know, we're working mostly on smaller shops, but we've got some broader campaigns that that are in play right now at this particular moment, a restaurant workers campaign that's gearing up, which is good because, you know, that's what the majority of folks in this town are doing, really, is working in restaurants and bars and clubs. And then some grocery workers campaign that's, like, had a couple stabs at a couple shops, and then there was a theater workers campaign as well. We're agitating and, you know, getting out there in a number of different ways. We've showed solidarity with other local struggles, especially there's a real problem with homelessness in our community, you know, partly as just a general side effect of the economic situation that's perpetual in this town, perennial, you know, a perennial problem. And then with things getting worse, there's even more people on the street. And Gainesville, in some ways, you know, is also a hub for travelers. We're close to Interstate 75. We're kind of not too far from the Georgia border. So a lot of people that are part of the waves that move north and south with the seasons of migrant workers and other folks that end up on the street at different points, and even, you know, lots of families, they end up in Gainesville. Some of them are deliberately trying to come here or to come to Florida, and some of them just kind of get stuck in Gainesville because it's kind of, you know, relatively speaking, an easy place to be there. You know, there's a lot of, it's a liberal town. There's a lot of access to basic needs like food and things, you know. I've heard a lot of the guys on the street say, "Well, if you're going hungry in Gainesville, you're just stupid," you know. But there's also a really reactionary business community that has tried every trick in the book to restrict access to resources for homeless people. So that's another fight. And the IWW has, you know, put our 2 cents in, you know, as labor activists saying, you know, look, we're for all workers, whether they have a job or not, you know. And we've been pushing on the minimum wage issue, you know, pushing for a living wage. And we're going to work some more on that. So that's kind of where we're at with that stuff.
One interesting thing was when we were driving around yesterday, you were talking about how there used to be quite a lot of small organic farms in the area, back before the organic market expanded enough for the corporations to come in, and they've now mostly closed, have they? I mean, I thought that was an interesting story.
Yeah, that was a real telling sort of grassroots capitalist drama that happened here that played out for us. I worked for the better part of 8 years as a farm worker on small organic farms here in the area, and I did a little tiny bit of migrant work a few summers working in the cornfields out west. But around here, it was all small family farms, as you say, and there was a trend in the 90s, you know, late 80s into the 90s that sort of, you know, got started with its roots in the back to the land and organic food movements in the 70s. And, you know, people started really getting a hold of pieces of land and trying to make it as farmers. And people around here started really being able to kind of make it as farmers in the late 80s and into the 90s. And I've heard, I can't say that I can back this up with science, but I've heard through the grapevine that Alachua County, which is the county that Gainesville is situated in, had one of the highest or the highest concentration of small family organic farms in the country at one point. You know, a lot of those farms have since folded with the wave of corporate investment in the organic market and the lowering of organic standards with the passing of the Federal Organic Standards Act, which lowered the bar and undercut like other sets of standards like the California Organic Standards and Oregon TILF and other more truly organic standards. So the big boys pushed the little guys out, you know, and it's just for me it was a real eye-opening lesson in the sort of how the mechanics of the capitalist system play out at the grassroots level and can just destroy anybody who's trying to do something different and go in a positive direction, you know. There's still a few small organic farms around, and we, ironically, having all these small organic farms around led to sort of mini revolution of farmers markets in the area. And sadly, the farmers markets didn't really get going until kind of the end of the small local organic farming trend. So, you know, now the farmers markets are full of people with like tie-dyed clothes and woven baskets and stuff from Guatemala, you know, and there's a few farmers that actually sell, but a lot of them are more like, you know, people with a gardening hobby than actual people trying to make a living farming. So it's kind of an ironic situation. Everybody loves the farmers market. It's a fun, great thing for the community. You know, it's one of the few public spaces. It's right in the downtown area, you know, right on our community plaza. So it's actually sort of like recreating a sense of, you know, a centering in the community. Folks come together, you know, you see people that you haven't seen in months or even years sometimes down at the farmers market, you know. So it's a great social phenomenon, but it has a sad sort of political economic irony behind it, you know.
Anything else locally that we've skipped over and should talk about?
Well, I guess I want to come back to talking about the Civic Media Center.
Yeah.
I think I got off on a tangent about our organizing model and didn't really say exactly what the place is so well. Our mission, our core mission, is to be an alternative library, and so the Lending Library has, not sure of the exact numbers, but, you know, tens of thousands of books, thousands of magazines and other periodicals. We have a special in-house zine library. We have also DVDs and VHS and CDs and audio cassettes available for checkout as well. And really, you know, a pretty amazing accumulation of information. And we've managed to partner with the local public library system through a small grant that we got from the Friends of the Library organization. So a goodly number of our books are now cataloged in the public library's collection and are accessible through their database. So if you can't find it at the public library, you can see that, oh, it's available at this alternative library, you know. So that brings us a few folks who come in and are actually, you know, excited about finding this book, and sure, they'll plunk down $10 for a membership and check out the book. So, you know, in addition to the library, as you mentioned, it's a relatively large space. You know, we have a pretty decent sized storefront, and we're able to have all kinds of events in the space. You know, we've got it's a split level building, and on the lower floor, that's the front of the shop. We've got a setup with, you know, chairs that can be moved out of the way and bookshelves on rollers and folding tables, so we can set up, you know, a pretty impressive small-scale events, like everything from we show movies every Monday night in the house with a screen and a projector to talks by, you know, local folks, one really important thing that we do is called firsthand histories, where we have participants from different organizations and movements come and actually describe from their own personal perspective, you know, and through their own experience, how a movement or an organization that they were involved with worked. And it's been a really incredible way of sharing with the wider community and also documenting firsthand testimony from the civil rights movement, the local gay rights movement, the second wave feminist movement, you know, in the 70s and 80s locally, and labor movements as well. So, you know, we try to record all these events, and then we have the testimony available for checkout to our members. So I feel like, you know, through events like that, we're able to provide this space where people can actually come together face-to-face, you know, and in the internet age, everybody kind of wrings their hands and opines about, you know, the increasing level of alienation. And, you know, we're able to use our website and our email lists to get people to come together face-to-face, you know, and kind of integrate those two realms. And so I really see that as an important and valuable aspect of having a physical space, you know. And I think that, you know, a lot of folks who come through here are really inspired by our example, and, you know, they say, gosh, every town ought to have a place like this, and I agree with them. Every town ought to have more than one place like this, really, you know, because there's multiple communities within every larger community, you know, and they have different needs and different culture and different politics and different perspectives. You know, I guess that's sort of another aspect of the Media Center, is because we are a small town, activists of different stripes that find themselves working on issues end up often really kind of having to work together, and that was certainly the case with the Gap Group and the Civic Media Center organization that grew out of it. It's definitely a coalition effort. It's not an ideological monocrop. You know, most info shop spaces that kind of self-identify with that term are anarchist spaces. And I myself am an anarchist, and I've been a grassroots anarchist organizer for, you know, over 15 years. But not everyone involved in the Media Center is an anarchist, and most of the folks that started it were actually, you know, liberals and progressives and some, like, kind of farther left folks. And it's still kind of a real mixed bag around here. You know, there are definitely folks that are what I identify as Marxist-Leninists, you know, and socialists of different sorts, democratic socialists, and then sort of kind of non-ideological radicals, you know, who refuse to pick an ism, you know, and folks like me who openly identify as anarchist, and lots of liberals, you know. So it all kind of works together, and surprisingly, the faction fights are few and far between and have not proved to themselves to be devastating. I think because everyone sees just by our work, by our pragmatic example of, you know, getting along and getting things done, that they don't need to go there, you know, in this organization or in their own organizations, you know. Some groups are ideologically pure, and that's fine for them, but I feel like that's kind of another lesson that I've learned working at the Civic Media Center, is that I can work with people across pretty significant ideological divides, you know, and we can agree to disagree where it counts, and we can get together and get some stuff done where it counts, you know. I feel like that's kind of a lesson that you're going to learn if you do real grassroots community organizing of any sort, but it's especially poignant in a space like this that really is about ideas, you know, and where people are really taking ideas very seriously and trying to weld them, you know, to the rest of their lives and develop a praxis of some sort.
So the traditional question I'm ending all these interviews with is the middle of the build-up to the U.S. elections. I'm actually out of touch with them in terms of exactly what's happening at the moment. But what wise comments have you to pass on your attitude toward these elections?
I don't know how wise my comments are. My immediate anarchist knee-jerk reaction is I really couldn't give a shit less, but I have to admit I pay some attention. For example, what's happening right now? Oh, well, you know, the primaries in Pennsylvania are looming, and it's a head-to-head duke-out between Obama and Clinton, and, you know, the gloves are coming off, and whatever, you know. But, you know, I kind of one of my favorite pieces of anarchist propaganda that I've seen in recent years came out around the 2004 elections, and I still haven't figured out quite who the brilliant people were that created it, but it was, I thought, pretty darn well done. And it was this little sort of folded up newsprint broadside with kind of the American flag on, you know, like a stylized American flag design on part of it, and it said, "Don't just vote," and "just" was kind of printed in red and kind of jammed in between "don't vote," you know, and it went on to talk about, you know, the problem is not Bush, the problem is the system, and kind of the standard anarchist analysis of no matter who you vote for, the system wins. But then they went on to say, but, you know, basically, I can't even really paraphrase them well, but it basically the gist of it was, you know, look, if you're feeling politically energized, like, here's all these other things to think about, you know, and here's all these other things that you could do, you know, and here's all these other directions that you could take that energy and that inspiration and those ideas, you know, that are kind of manifesting in your act of voting. And don't make that your one political act this year, you know. Kind of a challenge to actually go on and do something practical further.